Today's program was brought to you by Blueprint, the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. For more information, visit blueprint.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host today, Erin Fairbanks, and you're listening to a special community sessions. Today we're on the line with Linda Novak O'Keefe, who is the founding chief executive officer of Common Threads. Linda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you started Common Threads along with Chef Art Smith and artist Jesus Silguero back in 2003, and you guys were looking to create a nonprofit organization committed to educating Chicago's youth about cultural diversity, the culinary arts, and the importance of nutrition. And I'm curious, you know, in the intervening decade, how have things gone in realizing that vision?
Well, we've made it 10 years and just celebrated our 10-year anniversary, and things are going really, really well. You know, we started out, just because we believe at the most basic level, food really defines the quality of a person's life. And we have seen through our programs that we can help prevent childhood obesity and reverse the trend of generations of non-cookers while celebrating our cultural differences and the things people all over the world have in common. You know, food is very personal. It's we have personal ties to it, familial ties to food, as well as cultural ties. So that cultural piece is really important.
So what is it exactly that the organization does? I mean, those are admirable and lofty goals, but how does that work operationally?
Sure. So we teach children and families living in low-income neighborhoods the skills and knowledge of healthy living through in-school and after-school cooking programs, parent education, gardening classes, and summer camps. And we have programs running in Chicago, Miami, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Palo Alto. Through those programs, we're really building confidence in the kitchen and beyond and empowering those children and families to really eat together, because that's really important. Families that eat together 3 to 4 nights a week, those kids are less likely to smoke, drink, do drugs, and be obese.
So the program originally started in the Chicago area. How did you make the transition to more of a national organization?
It's really the demand for the program. We first expanded into the Los Angeles neighborhood at the suggestion of one of our funders. Michelle Bernstein, who is a chef in the Miami area, fell in love with the program and had to bring it to Miami. Art decided to open up a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and felt really strongly that we needed to expand into Washington, D.C. So it's been, we've gone as people have grown, as people have asked us to grow in the cities that they're in, and we're really, really lucky that we've made it work.
Yeah. Yeah.
National expansion is not easy. We actually just received a $720,000 impact investment from the Walmart Foundation to bring our full year program of study, and that's the in-school, after-school, gardening, parent educations, and summer camp programs to a total of 40 schools in Miami and Chicago. So that's a whole nother kind of level of expansion.
Wow, congratulations.
We're really excited. Thank you. Things are going really well, so we're thrilled.
So one of the things, I think the challenges about, you know, working with the communities that you engage with is the kind of insider, outsider, you know, community development aspect. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you kind of ensure that you're being, you know, sensitive to the needs and resources and demands of the communities when you're setting up a program. I mean, how do you engage stakeholders at all different levels of your programming?
Sure. Well, you know, I think that every city is different and every community is different, regardless of what city you're in. What we've learned to do is to really get the entire community involved as we decide to grow, because there really isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. So making sure that people have a voice and can talk about what their needs are is really important, and that conversation should be had, you know, with representatives across sectors. And we're really, really lucky to be at that really interesting intersection where we do have contacts across sectors, and, you know, including being part of the community. As far as making sure that we're being sensitive to the needs of the community members, you know, we're working in some of the most underserved neighborhoods in our nation, and, you know, all of our recipes, you know, on average use 5 ingredients that can easily be found in a food desert, cost under $10 to feed a family of 4, and take 20 to 30 minutes to make. So we're showing folks that this is really doable, it's accessible, and it's fun.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about those kind of like tools of the trade, you know, equipping kids to do this type of cooking or food preparation in the home, and how you ensure that there's a transition from the things that they're engaging with at camp or in the classroom to their ability to recreate those recipes at home. And I'm just thinking about a program here in New York, Corbin Hill Road Farms. They service neighborhoods up in the Bronx that are in food deserts. And one of the challenges they came across was, you know, refrigerator size, cooking equipment, and some of the ingredient challenges, kind of sourcing ingredients. And how operationally do you kind of equip the child to make the transition to food preparation outside of the areas where, you know, you're kind of the supervising body?
Sure. Well, we do regular sweeps of the neighborhood where we work in, so we can really understand what people, families are experiencing, you know, in their neighborhoods and what ingredients are available to them. So we're able to provide them with resource sheets of where to shop. On average, if people are living in a food desert, they could need to travel between 5 to 6 miles for groceries. But that's why we really tried to make sure that ingredients that we're making or recipes that we're making are using ingredients that are accessible, that you can find those ingredients in, you know, a liquor store. For example, one of our students in Los Angeles, his mom picked him up from Challengers Boys and Girls Club and didn't have, you know, realized that she couldn't find her wallet and didn't have any money and or anything at home to make dinner. And they scrounged around in their car and were able to put together $9. And he's like, "Mom, don't worry. We can swing by Aldi's right at home, and I'm going to make you this Senegalese peanut stew." And he picked up some kale and some peanut butter and some tomatoes and some rice and was able to make his mom dinner.
Wow. That's got to feel good.
Yeah.
You know, so one of the things that the kind of food movement is often accused of, this idea of, you know, elitism in the food movement and, you know, affordability, in particular in the neighborhoods that you provide services for, is a huge issue. But I do want to talk a little bit about the importance of of Providence. I mean, how, you know, where food is coming from, how it's grown, and does that make its way into your curriculum at all, or is that just not part of the conversation that you're having yet?
You know, I think that there's been a lot of improvements that have been happening as far as elitism in the food supply, if that's your question. You know, I think that, you know, it's been really great to see Walmart agreeing to stock their shelves with more healthful, clearly labeled products. It makes healthy, very affordable ingredients really accessible. I think that we need to focus. I'm just of that belief that you have to focus on a lot of the solutions and a lot of the things that are happening. But access is definitely something that so many of the families that I think that we're serving, that you know, families living in the Bronx and in Harlem are having a lot of challenges with.
Yeah, and what do you see? I mean, we've been talking a lot recently with the Edible Schoolyard projects and kind of looking at school lunch as this kind of lens to create change in the kind of diets of students and hence their kind of health outcomes, but also its ability to kind of shape the landscape that surrounds the school. And to me, that seems like you know, belies a real belief in the role of government kind of mandating change in the food supply and change in that system. Do you guys, I mean, does your funding come at all from a state or a national source, or is it completely independent funding? Do you do advocacy work on the policy end, or are you really focused on kind of programming?
You know, we do not receive any government funding. You know, it's something we're actually going to be looking into. But the obesity epidemic is caused by, you know, a toxic environment. I mean, it would be amazing if government could subsidize farms that grow nutritious food and better funding for schools so that food quality and physical education aren't sacrificed. Because as you just mentioned, you know, those things are key. Programs like ours are important and can help be the launching pad for a school-wide culture of health, but we're not the only factor in creating that school-wide culture of health. You know, it's important that, you know, the food quality is there for school lunches and that the kids can participate in phys ed. So I definitely think that, you know, you think of a lot of preventative funding being cut, and obesity is America's number one most preventable cause of death, ranked above smoking. So I definitely think it would be great to see, you know, additional government support
in that area, for sure.
Yes.
We are just going to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more of this idea that food defines the quality of a person's life. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
Great.
You're listening to Man of Sin by Brothers on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Stay tuned, everybody.
Blueprint is the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. Designed to purify and detoxify, Blueprint Cleanse is made from the freshest 100% raw and USDA-certified organic ingredients, cold-pressed to retain nutrients and flavor. Blueprint also offers a line of organic juices, cold-pressed and raw, in a variety of fruit and vegetable combinations, and available in individual bottles. Blueprint Cleanse is available at Whole Foods Market and many other retailers across the U.S. To learn more about their line of organic cleanses, juices, and other products, visit them today at blueprint.com or call them at 866-774-6831. That's 866-774-6831. Work hard, play hard. Cleanse, repeat.
All right, we are back. You are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network, and we are on the line with Linda Novak O'Keefe, who is the founding CEO of Common Threads. Now, Linda, at the top of the show, that you said, you know, at Common Threads, you share this belief that food, you know, more than anything, defines the quality of a person's life. And I want to push back on that a little bit, because, you know, I feel like here in New York, the news that we get coming out of Chicago, you know, incredible violence, broken school systems. You know, why is it that Common Threads decided that food was the space where they were really going to be able to affect change in people's lives?
Well, we all have to eat multiple times a day. you know, and there are certainly people that I've met one person in my lifetime who did tell me that he really is just could care less about food, and food is really nourishment. But most people love to eat. And I think that there have been so many studies that show that proper nutrition can help kids really stay focused in school. There are, you know, just the idea that families that are eating together, that those kids are less likely to smoke, drink, and do drugs. You know, I think that I think that food plays a really, really pivotal role in how your day goes. I know personally watching my own kids, what happens when they have sugar. And I know what happens when they have had breakfast and when they don't. You know, I just think that there's a domino effect. I think that the elitism of food and just food, the issues around food access were just really blatant and frustrating to me from a social justice perspective. And I think that everybody has the right to beautiful food, and that so much of what's happening with regard to obesity is lack of education, is this idea that we're surrounded by processed, packaged food, that people are snacking more and not eating proper meals, and I felt, and Jesus felt, and our entire chef community, and I know our staff shares the same beliefs, that that just by the simple act of preparing and sharing a meal, a lot of good can come out of that. And we've seen it. You know, after going through our program, 66% of those kids and families make the actual recipes at home. And, you know, that we're seeing kids actually just ignite change in their own family units, and break that cycle of generations of non-cookers. You know, the apple doesn't always fall far from the tree, and if you see obese children, you most likely will see obese parents. Obese parents have obese kids, and active parents have active kids, and this is just one way that we can help kind of break that cycle.
So, on that note, can you tell us a little bit about your 1 million kids campaign?
Yes, absolutely. So, we just finished our 5-year strategic plan, and We want to teach a million kids over the next 5 years how to cook through our full year program of study, our in school after school programs, as well as through strategic partnerships with other non for profits and partnerships across sectors. So we're really excited about what this will mean for the organization and just what it will mean to have a million kids cooking.
And as far as kind of programmatically, you know, I'm just a little curious, you know, you have the after-school programs, the summer camp, parent outreach, teacher training. Can you just break it down for us how those different aspects of your work evolved? I mean, I'm just curious, like, what came first and did you
sure.
realize you had a need for the second that prompted you to do the additional development?
No, absolutely. So the after-school cooking program came first, and that's a 10-week program. So each week the kids get on an imaginary airplane and they travel to a different country and explore that particular country and culture through making a ethnic recipe. That recipe, again, costs under $10 to feed a family of four, uses on average 5 ingredients, and takes 20 to 30 minutes to make. At that time, we saw that approximately 52% of the kids and families were making the recipes at home, at which point we then added the parent education piece because we realized that that parent buy-in was going to be critical to our success and to increasing that statistic, at which point once we did, we saw it jump to 66%. After the parent education, you know, the gardening curriculum was around the same time as the after-school curriculum as well as the summer camp, which is a really, really fun program, and it's free for kids participating in the free or reduced school lunch, and we have those camps running in Chicago and Miami. The summer camps have the kids cook each day for 2 hours a day. They garden. They do some type of active movement. They've done capoeira, which is an African-Brazilian martial art. They've done yoga. They've done some flamenco dancing before. and then they also have a culture class where they learn about the different countries and do arts and crafts from those, whatever particular country they're studying that week. The teacher training has been a new part of our in-school program where we're teaching teachers how to implement nutrition education in the classrooms. We've mapped our curriculum to the Common Core and Common Core subject standards as well as to meet national health standards. And teachers are given continuing education credits to go through this training. We believe that was the next kind of the spot of evolution for us to really try to create sustainability in the schools. So it wasn't just us coming in 10 weeks at a time, but what could we do to really help create this school-wide culture of health so we could see, so we could try to hopefully build healthier communities.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm curious if folks want to get involved, what's kind of the best way? I mean, they can obviously visit your website, www.commonthread.org, but what are some of the ways that people can engage with the organization?
Well, volunteers are really the lifeblood of the organization in the cities that we're working in. So if you're interested in volunteering, please, please email Bill at bfinn, at commonthreads.org.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Linda, and thanks for all your work. I'm definitely looking forward to, you know, the end of your five-year vision and the power of a million kids, hopefully more cooking strong across the country in the communities that you serve.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your interest.
Wonderful. So thanks for everyone to thanks to everyone for tuning in. A lot of twos there. This, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, are available for free as a download through iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher Smart Radio. But I do hope you'll visit the website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. We are wrapping up the end of our membership drive this May. So click that donate tab, become a member today. We'll send a tote and a card and some good swag out in the mail. In the meantime, keep tuning in and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.